The headlines: a Palestinian center files a complaint with the International Criminal Court over Israel's illegal land seizures. Britain is bracing for massive industrial strikes as millions are struggling to pay their energy bills and put food on the table. And Mali calls for an urgent meeting of the UN Security Council to present evidence of France supporting terrorist groups on its soil. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half-hour: Palestinians have submitted war crimes complaint against the Israeli regime to the International Criminal Court. The lawsuit by the International Center of Justice for Palestinians accuses Tel Aviv of unlawfully depriving Palestinians of property. It's filed on behalf of two families in the Gaza Strip and in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Al-Quds. It cites various examples in which the regime seized Palestinian lands and houses by force for its settlement activities or its separation, while the complaint calls on the ICC to include the cases it has submitted or intends to submit as part of a formal investigation. Israeli forces have killed another Palestinian youth. This happened during an attack by the regime's forces on the outskirts of the city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank. The 18-year-old Wasim Nasr Abu Khalifa succumbed to injuries he sustained after being hit by Israeli gunfire at Joseph's Tomb east of Nablus. This came after Palestinian resistance fighters exchanged fire with Israeli forces during an incursion on the holy site. At least 70 Palestinians were wounded in the ensuing clashes. According to Palestinian media, three Palestinians injured by the Israeli live fire are in critical condition. Earlier, our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil joined us with more on the latest Israeli killing of Palestinian youth and settlers' violations in the occupied territories.
Well, for the Israeli settlers, the Joseph Tomb or Yusuf Tomb east of Nablus, northern occupied West Bank, is considered very sacred for them. But it's inside the city of Nablus, inside the territory controlled or should be controlled by the Palestinian Authority. But despite this, the Israeli settlers continue to raid the area with the protection of the Israeli forces, of course. And during these raids and incursions, clashes take place, aggression continue to take place there. The Israeli forces shoot at the Palestinians there. And this will continue to anger the people in that area. As usual, clashes took place between the Palestinian resistance fighter and Palestinian youths. This fighting between them and the Israeli soldiers and the settlers at the same time. It's not the first time a Palestinian young man is killed in that area near the Joseph Tomb. This time, 18-year-old Wasim Nasr Abu Khalifa. We are speaking about over 36 Palestinians had been wounded.
Turkey has gone ahead with its offensive in northern Syria. The attacks took place near the town of Kobani between Turkish soldiers and U.S.-backed Kurdish militants. This has raised the prospect of a war as the Syrian army has vowed to directly respond to Turkish attacks on its soil.
Tensions are rising between Turkey and Syria. Ankara has launched airstrikes on military posts in northern Syria, killing several army soldiers and injuring several more. There are now concerns that a military operation in northern Syria by Turkish forces is imminent. Sources say a new cross-border offensive by Turkey looms large. Turkish forces have reportedly used loudspeakers in mosques in border areas close to the Jarablus city to ask people to stay indoors in preparation for the operation. Reports also say numerous Turkish combat drones could be seen flying in the skies over areas in proximity to the frontier. Turkish soldiers are also mobilizing in most of the border towns of Hasaka, Raqqa and Aleppo provinces. The Turkish president has already hinted at a possible military incursion. On August 8th, Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Ankara's decision to establish a 30-kilometer deep secure line along the country's southern border is final. Ankara says it's going to curb Kurdish militants operating in that area.
They want actually to annex the northern part of Syria. This is an ambition that that Turkey has to regain, to enlarge some territory that it once had. And I think this is not something that is acceptable either to Syria or even to Russia. Russia wants to have good relations with Turkey, but not at this price, I think.
The US-backed Kurdish People's Protection Unit, or YPG, militant group, which is the backbone of SDF, is present there. Ankara says YPG militants are terrorists. Damascus has warned Ankara against violating its sovereignty. Both Iran and Russia, which have been aiding Damascus in its anti-terror campaign, are also against Turkey's possible offensive. Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Ankara-backed militants were deployed to northeastern Syria in October 2019. Back then, Turkish forces launched a cross-border invasion to push YPG militants away. Since 2016, Turkey has launched three military operations inside Syria.
Turkey has reiterated its intention to create a 30-kilometer safe zone in northern Syria. In that case, this would overtake Kobani and other towns held by the so-called U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces. This would then bring Turkey into direct conflict with the U.S. Therefore, by default, it's the U.S. that is a source of instability. Washington has not only maintained its illegal presence in Syria, but keeps supporting Kurdish fighters and stealing Syrian oil.
When the crisis began on Syria in 2011, Ankara backed militants fighting against the government in Damascus. For years, it provided them with weapons and military support in a bid to topple the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
So this is perhaps just a what we sometimes call a red herring, that is something that will distract the observers from what is actually going on. It makes it appear, makes Turkey appear to be reasonable, when in fact they don't have a reasonable agenda at all. They have an unreasonable agenda.
However, there are signs that Turkey may have changed its policy on Syria. Just recently, it was revealed that the Turkish foreign minister had a brief conversation with his Syrian counterpart last October. The top Turkish diplomat has stressed that there needs to be a reconciliation between opposition groups and the Damascus government. There are reports that Ankara was evaluating the possibility of starting talks with the Syrian government. The leader of Turkey's Nationalist Movement Party has also supported comments to mend relations with neighboring Syria. Turkey now appears to be in a difficult position. The country's economy is now in its worst situation in decades. It's spending nearly $2 billion in northern Syria annually. And sentiments against Syrian refugees in Turkey are rising. That could potentially cost Erdogan his political career. In order to fix it, Erdogan needs to establish relations with Syria.
I think it's going to be a major problem. The Turkish attack indicates that they are not going to accept a reasonable compromise and to respect the territorial integrity of Syria. So this is going to be a major problem.
But at the same time, Ankara does not want to lose Syria card with regards to anti-Assad militants. However, its possible military adventure in northern Syria could trigger another catastrophe in a country which is in the midst of a prolonged crisis.
Iran condemns Wednesday's bomb blast targeting a mosque in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. The foreign ministry in a statement expressed sympathy with the families of the victims. The attack took place at the mosque in northern Kabul, where worshippers were holding evening prayers. The attack left 21 people dead and 33 others wounded. No group has claimed responsibility yet. Investigation into the incident is underway. Thunderstorms and flash floods wreak havoc in parts of Britain, including the capital, London. Footage shows heavy rain on Wednesday inundated streets. of Central London disrupting businesses as well as train and bus services. The Met Office had already issued alerts for thunderstorms and downpours. Pollution warnings are still in place for dozens of beaches in England and Wales, as untreated sewage has been discharged into the sea following the rain. The downpour followed weeks of record-breaking hot weather in Britain. July was declared the driest month in the UK in more than a century. The UK's bracing for a major industrial action as workers demand higher wages amid a cost-of-living crisis in the country. Railway workers, including those from London Underground as well as bus drivers, have planned to go on strike for 3 days starting from Thursday. Walkouts from the sector's biggest strike action in 30 years already this summer. Postal staff and dock workers are also joining the strike. The industrial action is expected to cause heavy disruption and travel chaos, especially in London and its suburbs. The workers are demanding higher salaries in line with rising inflation. And that's according to official data, is now at a 40-year high above 10%. Soaring food and energy prices are hurting millions of Britons. Saeed Purezo is joining us now from the British capital, London, to give us more details about this planned three-day strike. Saeed?
Yes, Barry. Here I am outside a train station in central London. The members of the RMT, the National Union of Maritime, Railway Maritime and Transport Workers, that started in the earlier hours of today and will continue until 1800 GMT. This is day one. There will be another day of strikes by the railway workers on Saturday. Tomorrow, though, as mentioned earlier, we will see the underground, that's Metro to you, and overground, as well as bus drivers in West London walking off. One of the ongoing strikes that have taken place and commenced in June and are still ongoing over a couple of reasons. Pay as well as working conditions, among others. What a dispute. You have two parties to this dispute. On one side, you have the government, who has agreed to 3% pay rise. And on the other hand, you have the members of the RMT, who are demanding more than 7% in the midst of the crisis over living costs. And what has happened so far is that neither party has agreed to back down. There's no sign of complacency on the side of either party. There's also working conditions. I've been talking to some of these people on the picket line here, telling me that their wages have been frozen for years now, that during the pandemic they were hailed as heroes. They were forced to go to work, whereas other people were sitting home and receiving furlough pay. And now that there is time, which is the time, rather, for them to receive a pay rise that keeps up with the inflation rate that has hit the double digits, they're being told that no such thing will happen. And if you really factor in the inflation rate, Bardia, you're looking at a 3% wage cut for these workers. But the fact of the matter is that there is support for these people online and in real life. I've been talking to some of the people who will consider it as an inconvenience, all the disruptions as a result of this strike action, but they have sympathy for these people and are hoping that they will reach some kind of a deal with the government. RMT have long said, look, we don't have a problem with the government saying they are going to modernize the railway system. But this should not come at the cost of our workers losing their jobs or agreeing to a pay rise that is well below the inflation rate. So the dispute between these two sides is ongoing. Perhaps what has stoked public anger and enraged these workers is common by the prime ministerial hopeful, Liz Truss, recently, who said that she, of course, it's not just her position, the whole government's position is to restrict the right to strike. Of course, they haven't said it in so many words, but they have said that they're going to have to, calling on the RMT and their unions, that they will have to run a minimal service while they're striking, which is sort of antithetical or oxymoronic, because those same people who will be striking will have to run the service. It's not possible.
All right, thanks a lot. Said Puruzo joining us from London. Elsewhere, the Malian foreign minister accuses France of supporting terrorist groups in his country, where Paris maintained its military presence until a few days ago. In a letter to the UN Security Council, Abdoulaye Diop calls for an urgent meeting in order for Bamako to present evidence. It says French fighter jets, drones, and military helicopters breached Mali's airspace more than 50 times this year. The letter says those flagrant violations were used by France to collect intelligence for terrorist groups operating in the Sahel region and to drop arms and ammunition for them. France has rejected the allegations, which comes just days after it announced the final withdrawal of forces from Mali. France deployed troops to its former colony under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but many Malians consider the mission a failure. Well, Ukraine says a new Russian strike on the eastern city of Kharkiv has claimed the lives of two civilians and injured 18 others. The regional governor calls the shelling of Kharkiv most tragic since Russia's offensive began in February. The strike comes the day after Kiev reported the death of seven civilians in a Russian attack on the same city. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has vowed revenge, saying the attack is not justifiable. Separately, Ukrainian forces claim they have killed, quote, 29 occupiers in a counterattack on the southern city of Kherson. Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is set to meet with the presidents of Ukraine and Turkey in the Ukrainian city of Lviv. This as Moscow says Kiev is preparing for a provocation at the Russian-held nuclear power plant.
The Kiev regime is preparing a resonant provocation at Zaporizhia nuclear power plant on August 19th during the visit of UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to Ukraine. As a result of his provocation, the Russian Federation will be blamed for creating a technological disaster at the power plant.
The Russian official said Moscow has not deployed any heavy weapons at the plant or near its compound. He said Kiev has been spreading rumors that Russia is occupying the plant, targeting Ukrainian forces, and using the site as a shield. Europe's largest nuclear power plant has come under several strikes in recent weeks. Both Russia and Ukraine have traded accusations over the attacks. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on January 23, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alaiha.
A hay'at is a social unit and institution that pivots around love for the household of the Prophet. The basis for the formation of this small or big institution is the love for the household of the Prophet and guiding towards their goals. This is the truth about and the nature of hay'ats. They first took form during the time of the Imams themselves. This is not something that has been established today or was established in the recent past. It was the companions of the Imams who first established hay'ats. They used to gather after the event of Karbala. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam asked a narrator of traditions, "Do you sit together and speak about us?" The narrator answered, "Yes." Those gatherings were the basis for the formation of hay'ats.
اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Later, the Imam stated, I love such gatherings. May we be sacrificed for his love and his heart. He said, I love such gatherings and you must keep our issue alive. The Arabic word amrana was frequently used by the Imams. It means our issue. It is the fundamental issue on the basis of which we move and act. If we want to use modern words, although this may detract from its true meaning to some extent, we should say that amrana means our path in our school of thought. Ihya amrana means keep our path in our school of thought alive. There is another narration in the book Al-Kafi which says, remind one another of our issue and keep it alive. So, the Hay'ats date back to that time and they have continued in the history of Shia. It might have taken on different forms. If researchers study this, they can find more details. But they have continued until they reached our time. In certain periods in history, they have been greatly effective, such as during the time of the revolution. You young people do not remember this. During the time of the revolution, the Hay'ats were very effective. They distributed astonishing elegies in the form of cassettes throughout the country. For example, an elegist would read an elegy in Jahrom or in Yazd, and it would become very popular.
You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
China has slammed a visit to Taiwan by a group of American legislators, saying it has fully exposed Washington's true face as the spoiler of peace in the strategically sensitive Taiwan Strait. A U.S. congressional delegation, led by Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts, arrived in Taipei on Sunday and met with the island's president, Tsai Ing-wen, on an unannounced two-day visit amid tensions between Beijing and Washington over a recent controversial visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to the self-ruled island. In a statement, China's defense ministry said that the U.S. lawmakers' trip is against Beijing's sovereignty and territorial integrity and fully exposes the true face of the United States as a spoiler and spoiler of peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait. The ministry also vowed to smash any form of foreign interference in its domestic affairs. In response to the visit, China's defense ministry also carried out more exercises near Taiwan. The military says the exercises are a stern deterrent to the U.S. and its political games undermining regional peace. Meanwhile, the Chinese Foreign Ministry said the latest visit is a blatant violation of the One China principle.
China once again urges the U.S. to abide by the One China principle and the three Sino-U.S. joint communiques, handle Taiwan-related issues prudently and properly, and stop going further down the wrong path of hollowing out and distorting the One China principle so as not to cause further damage to China-U.S. relations and peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait.
The spokesman added that a small number of U.S. politicians are colluding with Taiwan's separatist forces. He said they are unaware of their limits and their efforts are doomed to failure. The visit by Pelosi promoted Beijing to react with an unprecedented burst of military activity, launching its biggest ever military drills around Taiwan. China considers Taiwan to be a breakaway province that should be reunited with the motherland under the internationally recognized One China policy.
What we see is the U.S. trying to provoke tensions where they don't have to. What we have to keep in mind is since 1972, under the Shanghai Communique, the United States government has recognized that there is only one China. Taiwan is part of China. But what we see right now with these tensions being built up is the U.S. trying to manipulate international law and use the idea of American exceptionalism to say that it's trying to help Taiwan and it's not trying to provoke tensions between Taiwan and China.
Tensions between the U.S. and China simmer at a new high since House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan earlier this month. Now, the U.S. President's Indo-Pacific coordinator, Kurt Campbell, has revealed that Washington will send aircraft and warships to the Taiwan Strait in the coming weeks, claiming the U.S. expects China to put more pressure on Taipei in the next few months. The senior White House official also stated that Washington is going to announce an ambitious roadmap for trade with Taiwan in the coming days. That's while China claims Taiwan as its own territory and has repeatedly warned against the island's growing ties with Washington. Tensions are high, and the bill moving through Congress threatens to overturn Sino-U.S. relations and could prompt a stronger response from Beijing. The Taiwan Policy Act aims to upgrade ties with the island by designating it as a major non-NATO ally. The Taiwan Policy Act of 2022 would also bolster Taiwan's defense capabilities with $4.5 billion in security aid.
I mean, what the U.S. is doing right now is trying to continue to impose U.S. hegemony in Asia, with the U.S. losing hegemony in places like Latin America. It is trying to stay relevant and maintain the relationships that it does have.
It's obvious that the U.S. is only continuing to elevate tensions with China, and Taiwan could end up being caught in the middle of a conflict.
The attack, which occurred just outside one of the gates of the occupied old city of Al-Quds on early Sunday, left at least 9 Israeli settlers injured, 2 of whom are in serious condition. Reports indicate that at least one person ambushed a bus as it arrived at the western wall in the old city. Witnesses say that as people were boarding the bus, they heard gunshots, screams, and warnings that this was an attack. The bus driver has told Israeli media that he tried to pull away, but was unable to do so. Since then, Israeli troops have been raiding homes in a Palestinian neighborhood, and reports have emerged that several suspects were involved and that some were even arrested. Palestinian resistance groups have described the attack as a natural response to the occupying Israeli regime's daily crimes against the Palestinians, calling it a heroic act. The world, however, has remained silent when atrocities against Palestinians occur, which is on a daily basis. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights reports daily killings, detainments, and other Palestinian violations, which is described as a slow death and genocide against Palestinians. But those killings don't even get reported. This attack took place in the occupied Al-Quds, where Israeli troops have been stationed in large numbers. But doesn't the fact that it took place there mean that Israel is failing to prevent these attacks from occurring?
Well, the first thing to understand in the conflicts that we see developing is that the Israelis, of course, are the responsible party for a lot of the antagonism and the aggression and the attacks that are constantly erupting in Al-Quds, in the Palestinian territories, because they are constantly waging a program of genocide and attempting to remove all ethnic natural inhabitants of the lands and replace them with Israeli settlers. So what the Palestinians and other people do in these areas that are being subjected to forced extermination and relocation is the same thing that any free people would do. If anyone, including myself, was forced to leave my home or evicted or lost loved ones and experienced such a horrific a program of expulsion that the Israelis daily practice, of course people would be responding with any kind of militant response that they possibly could.
Last week, Israel carried out its latest round of aggression against the Palestinian people under the pretext that it was thwarting a terror attack by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Despite the Israeli atrocity, Palestinians did strike a ceasefire deal with the regime. But the truce is widely believed to be fragile in some sense, as the Palestinians did stop their retaliatory attacks, but Israel has yet to heed their demands. All this, along with the long list of previous Israeli attacks and atrocities against Palestinians, has led to an atmosphere of tension and frustration in the occupied Al-Quds. While the US and Europe condemn the attack, they're encouraging Ukrainians to resist the Russian war, even calling for armed resistance against Russian forces. This shows the double standard approach they have towards Palestinians. But the latest Israeli attack is only one in a long list of the regime's atrocities against the Palestinians on a daily basis. From the destruction of their homes to false imprisonment and the murder of innocent people, including women and children. All this has led to widespread anger among Palestinians whose rights have been violated, leading them to take action themselves. But the question remains, will attacks similar to the bus incident increase since the Israeli violations against Palestinians will continue?
Well, the only way that the crimes against the Palestinians that the Israelis are perpetuating will end, will stop, is when the Israeli government, the Israeli people, rise up and tell their government, we cannot survive the counterattacks any longer. We cannot endure the pain and the suffering that is being inflicted upon us. So we are demanding that the government be overthrown, replaced with new leadership that will honestly and authentically seek out peaceful negotiations of peaceful coexistence that take into account a lot of the crimes and violations of treaties that have occurred in the past, but that are dedicated to moving forward in a positive, mutually agreeable way. So the Israelis and the Israeli people really are the ones that have to suffer and before they recognize that their own government, their own military are perpetuating the suffering of the Israeli people, because the Palestinians are never going to relent. They're never going to stop fighting for their lives, fighting for their children, and fighting for their homes.
How many wars is the United States fighting right now? Well, the answer is zero, as under the Constitution, Congress must declare war, and the last countries that Congress declared war on were Bulgaria, Romania, and Hungary in 1942. 8 decades and what seems to be zero wars. Any countries with such a record must be one of the most peaceful places on Earth. But as history has shown, this is not the case with the US, as it is fighting and has waged wars on many countries across the world. It just doesn't want to call them wars. Over the last 20 years, the U.S. has dropped an average of 46 bombs and missiles on other countries each day. And now, a new study has revealed that more than a quarter of the 400 wars which the U.S. has sugarcoated in terms such as a military-led operation, police actions, or humanitarian interventions have taken place in West Asia and Africa. So it seems that as Americans struggle to address urgent needs at home, their governments have committed them to endless wars in an attempt to support what seems to be one of the key pillars of the U.S., the military-industrial complex. The
U.S. has tried to be on the first hand with an image of also being seen as a global policeman, which came and, of course, as some have argued, it's done more harm than good. When you look into the global dominance and production of all these weapons and also use of it in terms of interventions, you see a situation whereby U.S. wants to be the first, to be seen the most powerful nation in the world, to be seen as the one that can intervene and maybe make a difference, whichever difference whose interest it serves. Of course, they will have to define that. It's a big and gray area. You cannot define it very clearly.
The world seems to have entered a new era after the Second World War, one where relations between countries has been at a much more stable and peaceful state. But while the decline of war and the relative harmony among great powers is cause for celebration, the U.S. seems to believe otherwise in light of its grand strategy and political powers that seem to be running its system, namely the military-industrial complex. The U.S. has constantly, since the Cold War, intervened in foreign affairs and engulfed itself in wars far from its borders, wars which in most cases seemed endless and even pointless at times. But while the U.S. military is swamped in conflicts in other countries, it's hard to see any end in sight, especially an end where it is the victor. A month into his presidency, Donald Trump said that the U.S. no longer wins wars as it once did. And the reason behind this might be the fact that the U.S. isn't necessarily in wars. It is, in fact, in foreign interventions where its presence has more often than not worsened the situation, further aggravating an already chaotic crisis. And all this may only be to support the thriving war business in the U.S. Big war CEOs say the chaos in the world has led to excellent prospects for them, while arms contractors say recent violence and tensions in the Ukraine conflict works in their shareholders' favor. And this leads to the questions that do war manufacturers and U.S. foreign policy go hand in hand in promoting wars?
You think about the terrorism happening within the Sahel region, and of course, U.S. is an intervention in power also. They have to do what they have to do, use of drones and all these things. So they are giving us another reason as well. But elsewhere, whether it's in East Africa, Somali intervention, this is also given a different recent campaign, war against terror. So there's always a reason being given. So therefore, war never looks like it's been manufactured or it's been planned, deliberately planned or calculated to maybe maximize sales of weapons. But truth be told, that whenever there's a conflict, weapons will always be used.
The U.S. Justice Department says FBI agents have found 11 sets of classified documents, with some marked as top secret, in Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Florida while executing a search warrant this week. The warrant was publicly released following a federal judge's order. It states investigators had probable cause to believe Trump violated three federal crimes, including violating the Espionage Act, obstruction of justice, and criminal handling of the government records. Media reports say the FBI search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago home was for possible classified materials related to U.S. nuclear weapons. Trump, however, rejected that. He called it a hoax and claimed he had no stored classified information. The unprecedented raid on the residence of the former U.S. president provoked a backlash from leading Republicans who described the move as politically motivated. The Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, said the search of Trump's property was another escalation in the weaponization of federal agencies against the regime's political opponents. Also, Florida Senator Marco Rubio stated that Biden is using his power to persecute Trump. But the White House has denied the allegations, saying it was unaware of the search before it happened. Moreover, there have been growing threats in recent days against FBI agents and offices across the country. On Thursday, a man who tried to breach the FBI's Cincinnati office was shot and killed by police after he fled the scene. Law enforcement officials say the man may have been present at the January 6th riot. Right after news of the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago broke, there was a big spike in tweets referencing civil war. Analysts and reporters say this is alarmingly similar to the activities in the lead-up to the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
Well, I think it's true that there are people in the permanent national security wing of the U.S. government who don't want Trump to return to office. And whether or not those people are currently raiding Trump in Mar-a-Lago in order to try to get proof of crimes they could use to charge him and put him in a position where he legally can't run for office.
Shockwaves spread across America in response to the news that the FBI had searched the private Florida residence of Donald Trump. It prompted threats of retaliation from the former U.S. president and his allies. The surge in violent rhetoric drew concerns that it could lead to civil unrest and a social crisis. Department of Homeland Security officials have been warning for months that this type of warlike rhetoric, which came to fruition on January 6th and which continues to be fueled by reactions to ongoing investigations of Trump, is increasing the risk of more widespread political violence ahead of the midterm elections in November. This comes as recent polls have shown a rising acceptance of political violence among Americans. About 1 in 3 Americans say they believe violence against the government can at times be justified. According to another study by researchers at the University of California Davis Violence Prevention Research Program and the California Violence Research Center released last month, more than half of Americans expect that a civil war will erupt in the U.S. sometime in the next few years.
I think it is a sign that the U.S. Polarization has gotten way out of hand and could be leading to a constitutional crisis and possible civil war or social breakdown kind of situation. We have seen this polarization growing for many years.
Meanwhile, as much as 40% of election and poll workers in the largest jurisdictions in the U.S. have so far said they won't be returning to their jobs out of their own fears. Other states are seeing drop-offs too. Nearly 1 in 3 local election workers said they felt unsafe because of their jobs. The alarming partisan divide within the U.S. political system ahead of the vital midterm elections in November had raised concerns over the possibility of internal conflict.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
last savior.
Oh, the savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program, The Last Savior. I'm your host, Zainab Askari. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Dr. Ali Alavi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much, and thanks for inviting me to your show.
So, Dr. Alavi, we have been discussing the common points between Ashura and Mehtaviyat. You said there's fighting ignorance, and we discussed different forms of ignorance. And then you said there's establishment of Islamic government. Another was to revive the concept of Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahy al-Munkar, to revive the concept of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil.
Yes, we have been talking about two common factors among the government of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and the goals of the uprising of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Enjoining the good and forbidding the evil is one of the most important and vital values in Islam.
Yeah.
That is, no other value can be actually seen next to that. And we have in a hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam that says, all of your actions, even fighting for the sake of God, that is jihad,
yeah,
is like a drop in comparison to Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahy an Munkar.
Oh.
It shows the importance of that concept, that it has to be revived.
All right.
What do we mean? Whatever is bad, we have to show our hatred towards whatever is bad, and we have to say something, and we have to do something,
yeah,
in front of whatever is bad. And yeah, whatever is good, we have to strengthen that.
Yeah.
And this is our duty as a Muslim, as a duty bar. The front of Haqq and the front of Baal are two total different things.
Yeah.
So we cannot be either a bit Haqq or a bit Baal.
Yeah.
So we are either Haqq or either Baal. Allah says, Ja'al Haqq.
Yeah.
Whenever haq comes, batil goes. They cannot be combined.
One heart contains one rule.
Exactly.
A Husayni heart cannot be a Yazidi heart at
definitely
the same time.
So when the people of the time of Imam Husayn alayhi salam were silent about the selection of Yazid as the leader of the Islamic Ummah.
Yeah.
So they have to be waiting for a lot of catastrophes at that time.
So if you're not directly involved in the sin, in the oppression, watching the crimes as a silent...
Again, you have your own share there.
Yeah, you are.
So you have your own share of being, for example...
So you don't have to be a silent watcher.
In every sin that this government is actually committing, you have your own share.
Exactly. So currently we're seeing the situations, the oppression all around. We don't have to look at it as silent watchers. So if we are watching it and saying nothing,
brilliant,
we have a share.
If we see that the madloon, oppressed people, are under oppression,
yeah,
we are not allowed to be silent. It doesn't matter if he is a Muslim or not Muslim,
yeah,
as long as they are humans. Some might say, no, okay, we have only our duties and we have our obligations for the Islamic Ummah. No, it's not true. When we see, for example, sort of apartheid regime comes in South Africa, it's again our duty as a Muslim to defend those who are under oppression. It is for all Muslims. Again, in order to any Muslim society is under oppression, it's our duty again to defend them. So that's why Imam Husayn alayhi salam says that I am coming with the intention of reforming the ummah of my grandfather, that
all
is
right,
the Holy Prophet.
Yeah.
And I come to enjoin the good and forbid the evil.
Yeah.
So this is what he clearly and explicitly actually states.
Yeah.
So this is the intention of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Again, the same thing will happen at the time of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Imam Baqir alayhi salam was asked about this verse of the Holy Quran, الَّذِينَ مَكَّنَّهُمْ فِي الْأَرْضِ أَقَامُوا الصَّلَاةُ وَآتُوا الزَّكَاةِ. He was asked, what is this verse about? Imam says that this is about the government of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and his companions.
Okay.
At the end of this narration, Imam says that Mahdi, look, when aqamu salat wa atu zakat, they are going to set up prayers and pay zakat, and it means, does it mean that it was not going to be practiced at that time? That aqama means something that they are going to establish something. Mm-hmm. It means as if it has not been there.
Yeah.
So Imam says that they are coming to to do enjoining the good and forbidding even from the evil. This is what Imam Baqir alayhi salam said about the government of Imam Mahdi. So the same thing is going to be repeated again at the time of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Yeah.
Whatever was left as munkar, it has to be cleared and cleaned from the sin of the earth by his presence, inshallah.
Do you think, Dr. Alavi, like we should wait for Imam to come and he will just come and start invite people towards the good and then forbid them from the evil? Or like we as who claim to be the soldiers of Imam have the duty, have the same duty as well?
Look, the same thing happened at the time of Imam Hussein, alayhi salam. Some people were silent. So yeah. Imam actually criticized those who have been silent. Even if they are few in number, they are not allowed to be silent. And Imam criticizes them. At the time that we see something against the expediency of the Islamic Ummah, when we find this ability to tell, for example, a brother, a sister, that whatever you are doing is wrong, this is the minimum thing that we can do.
Yeah. So we as the waiters of Imam, it's
we have to do our taklif or our duty whenever or wherever we are.
And I think what we learned from the Husseini school of thought is that it's not always done by just sermons or just lecturing.
Mm.
It could be done by actions as well. Like Definitely. We have seen the first Shaheed of the Husseini way, the one who was on the opposite path, Hur. And now we don't call him just Hur, we just send salutations to him and put Hazrat in front of his name. And he changed his path totally through the actions. Imam actually did not lecture him or start sermoning him. It was just the action of Imam that invited him towards the good and forbid the evil. So that's one of the great lessons for the claimants of waiters of Mahdiyyah, that it's also the actions that can invite people towards the good.
Exactly. As the waiter of the Imam, first we have to have our actions and a'mal and deeds to be in the right way that the Imams ask us to be.
Yeah.
We have to be the case and the cause of beauty for them.
Yeah.
And not to be the cause of, let's say, ugliness or bad actions and bad deeds for the Ahlul Bayt
alayhim. All right. So your actions should actually reflect you're the follower of Imams.
Definitely. So when we adopt our actions, we perform, we do whatever we are going to do based on what we are understanding or we are taking from them, the lessons that we are taking from them. So this is what we are actually doing, our duty based on that. Imam Hussein al-Islam tells us, standing in front of Tawud, that we, inshallah, we reach to that point again, not paying allegiance with the Tawud of the time, the arrogance of the time, to accept, for example, and to be silent with the massacre that is being done in, let's say, in Palestine. No, unfortunately, this wrong understanding of duties is in a deviated groups of Muslims that cannot be accepted.
All
so
right.
As a muntadhir, as a waiter of the Imam, we have to wait Imam as we earlier explained, how should we show our waiting for the Imam? By our actions, by our words, by as much as we can do.
We'll discuss more on that after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
This is The Last Savior. We're talking about the common points between Ashura and Mahdiyyah. Dr. Alavi, you were talking about the concept of inviting people towards good and forbidding from the evil.
Mm. There is one last point that I want to mention, that Imam Hussein felt this necessity inside the Islamic Ummah, the Ummah of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, his grandfather, that he found that Sunnah of the Prophet has been forgotten. And in a letter that he sent to the people of Basra, Imam said that, I invite you to the Sunnah of the Holy Prophet that was forgotten, that actually was removed from Islamic Ummah. In case you accept my invitation and follow me and obey me, I'm available to guide you.
Okay.
So this is, again, the duty of Imam. Imam knows his duty well.
Yeah.
This is the duty of Imam, that he is after enjoining to the good, that, okay, I'm coming to revive the Sunnah of the Holy Prophet, to perform this Amr bil Ma'ruf and do Nahi anil Munkar, to refrain you from doing and acting anything evil or bad.
Yeah.
So again, in this concept has been actually stated explicitly in the words of Imam, in the letters of Imam, in manners, in actions of Imam. And it was seen till end of his holy life. Again, the same thing, inshallah, will happen at the time of Imam alayhi salam, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. When he comes, people are waiting for a person that materializes and actualizes the Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahi al Munkar. And at that time, and in a Mahdavi culture, in a Mahdavi community, in Mahdavi society, mm-hmm. people themselves correct each other.
All right.
They warn each other of, okay, this action is going to be done in this way or in that way. So this is where, inshallah, this is where Imam Mahdi alayhi salam has set up a government, and hopefully, with grace of God, we shall be in that government.
Inshallah. And we also see the way of Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahy al Munkar in be it Imam Hussein al-Islam or any other Imams. I mean, the way of inviting people to its good has been very, very different and interesting. Like Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein al-Islam see a person performing wrong mm-hmm. wuzu, and then they don't tell him directly. They just...
Exactly.
In a very beautiful way. They don't even directly teach that person. They indirectly teach that person so that he does not feel disgraced and all. It's
how
all,
beautifully they taught him.
That's actually a big message for us, especially the seminary students who are always in the process of inviting people to where it's good, who just think it's obligatory over them, and then they get so much into it, and then they just forget the ways. They just sometimes... be a little hard or harsh in their tones, and their tones may sometimes make the process mm-hmm. worse rather than making it better. And one of the important things I was going through in the Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahy al Munkar was that you have to stop people when they are doing haram, not all the time, because sometimes we just, for example, me as a waiter, I think that Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahy al Munkar is wajib on me, and I try to avoid everyone from everything, whatever they're doing, whether they're doing haram or not. If in my concept it's not correct thing,
yeah. When we say something, sister, we have to know the prerequisites and conditions of that.
Exactly.
So for Amr bin Ma'ruf, we first want to actually bring the attention of the brothers and sisters who are listening to this show to what the importance of this.
Yeah.
And later, inshallah, in case there is an opportunity, we have to talk about the conditions of Amr bin Ma'ruf.
Exactly.
How? Sometimes our Amr bin Ma'ruf, that is enjoining the good, is just to act ourselves, to act based on the Islamic teachings in the real sense.
Yeah.
See, this is Amr bin Ma'ruf.
All right.
Sometimes it is, but not doing something.
Yeah.
Right? Sometimes it is by saying only yes or no. Sometimes it is by saying a word. Sometimes by saying, no, I disagree.
Yeah.
You see, there are different forms of Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahy al Munkar. To stand in the middle of the street and say, okay, this is good, this is bad. This might be our wrong, let's say, understanding of even social.